Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week on Culturetopia, the backstory of the banjo, the quintessentially American instrument, turns out to be rooted in Africa. A new reality show, Russian Dolls, features ladies in Brighton Beach living large. But residents of the New York neighborhood known as Little Odessa say this reality is anything but. And film critic Bob Bondello compares the new remake of the film Brighton Beach to its unsettling 1947 original. But first,
the banjo has been part of American music for more than 250 years. It was brought here from Africa by slaves. NPR's Greg Allen brings us the story of one man who is tracing the connections between the banjo and an instrument called the akanting.
My father was born with this instrument. This was part of our history.
Lemu Ahuma Daniel Jota is a slim man who looks much younger than his 55 years. He's from Gambia, a member of the Jola people. This song, written by his father, talks about the closeness of Gambia and Senegal, two countries that in pre-colonial days used to be one. Gambia, yeah, Safi, Safi, yeah, the akanting is a three-stringed instrument with a long neck and a body made from a calabash gourd with a goatskin stretched over it. Jota's father and cousins played it, but he didn't think much about the instrument until 1974 when he was visiting the U.S. from Gambia, attending a junior college in South Carolina. He recalls watching TV with some of the other students.
There was this music program from Tennessee, and they call it country music. Well, I watched the program, and I saw the modern banjo being used into it, and the sound just sounded like my father's akanting.
That experience put Jota on a journey to explore the banjo's connections with the instrument he grew up with. The banjo came to America with the slaves, and musicologists have long looked in West Africa for its predecessors. Much of the speculation has centered on the ngoni and the kalam, two hide-covered stringed instruments from West Africa that have some resemblance to the banjo. But they're just two of more than 60 similar plucked stringed instruments found in the region. Over the next two decades, while he pursued undergraduate and graduate degrees in the U.S., Jota learned everything he could about the origins of the banjo, and eventually he reached a conclusion.
Among all the instruments ever mentioned as the prototype of the banjo from the African region, the akanting to me has more similarities, more objective similarities than any other that has ever been mentioned.
For one thing, the akanting looks like a banjo. It has a long neck that, like early banjos, extends through the instrument's gourd body. It has a movable wooden bridge that, as in banjos, holds the strings over the skin head. But for Jota and other banjo scholars, most convincing is how the akanting is played. Using a downward stroke, players use the index finger to strike down on one of the long strings, and the thumb sounds the akanting's short string as the hand moves back upward. When Jota looked at early banjo instruction books from the mid-1800s, he found they described an almost identical playing style.
And what struck me was when they mentioned that the ball of the thumb and the nail of the index or the middle finger, I knew straight away my father was using the same style. That was never a surprise to me because I have seen this since I was 5 years old.
That early style of playing predates the three-finger style used today by nearly all bluegrass banjo players. Something similar is still used by folk and country musicians who play in a style sometimes called frailing or clawhammer. After doing 10 years of research supported by a Swedish university, in 2000, Jata presented his findings first in Stockholm and then a few months later at a banjo collectors' convention in Boston. Greg Adams is a banjoist and graduate student in ethnomusicology at the University of Maryland. He says Jata's findings on the accounting have forced many scholars to rethink their assumptions about where to look for information about the banjo's ancestors.
A lot of the emphasis up to that point was largely focused on griot traditions, which is extremely important as part of the conversation as we look to West Africa. But what the accounting did was open up a new line of discourse.
The ngoni and kalim are instruments typically played by griots, praise singers who enjoy special status in many West African tribes. Adams says the accounting is a folk instrument, played not by griots, but by ordinary people in the Jola tribe. In terms of which tradition has the most direct connection to the banjo, Adams believes it's a mistake to think of it as an either-or proposition.
Each of these traditions deserves to be explored, experienced, examined, and appreciated on their own terms.
Jata plans to continue his work documenting the accounting musical tradition, its connections to the banjo, and other areas of Jola culture through a research and education center he's founding back home in Gambia. Greg Allen, NPR News.
When the film Fort Apache, The Bronx came out in 1981, it was a hit. Paul Newman played a conflicted cop in a neighborhood ravaged by poverty and drugs. Fort Apache was also controversial. Local community leaders fought with the producers and threatened to sue because of the way the film depicted blacks and Puerto Ricans. As part of our series On Location, NPR's Joel Rose visits the South Bronx 30 years later.
Fort Apache, The Bronx opens in an empty lot full of rubble. A graffiti-covered subway car rumbles by on an elevated track, and a strung-out prostitute, played by Pam Grier, walks up to a police car, where two rookie cops are still sipping their morning coffee.
Y'all want to come party with me?
Not now, baby.
I got some fine for New York's finest.
Well, we're on the job.
I'm on my job, too, just like you. An important job. Y'all just take a look at this.
After shooting the cops, Greer stumbles off. Local citizens emerge from the shadows, grabbing the badges and wallets out of the cops' pockets. At the time, New York City cops really did talk about the neighborhood as hostile territory. That's how the station house in the 41st precinct earned the nickname Fort Apache.
You know, our lockers were on the third floor, and somebody from across the street shot arrows through the window.
Former cop Peter Tessitore worked at the 41st precinct in the 1960s. The way Tessitore tells it, one of his colleagues did not take kindly to those arrows.
And Gil said, you know, with a little profanity, what the is this? Fort Apache meaning John Wayne's movie with Indians, etc.
The movie is loosely based on the experiences of Tessitore and another former officer. They were the inspiration for the main character, Murphy, played by Paul Newman. Murphy is a tough but honest cop who cheerfully keeps order on his beat, delivers the occasional baby, and flirts with the nurse at the local hospital.
You need a drink.
I need a nurse.
You supply the booze, I'll supply the nurse.
You asking me out? I get asked out by about 200 nurses every day. Why should I say yes to you?
Because you say yes to all the others.
The 41st Precinct earned another nickname, too, Little House on the Prairie. By 1980, two-thirds of the people who lived in the precinct had fled. Hundreds of landlords resorted to setting buildings on fire to collect the insurance money. And community activists who remained in the South Bronx were not happy to see a high-profile Hollywood production.
They were in our neighborhood. This was our territory. And they were an invading force. They were here to really do us harm. Not physical, but rather film something that was not totally true.
This is Herson Barrero. In 1980, he was part of a group of local activists who called themselves the Committee Against Fort Apache. They got a copy of the script before shooting, and they complained that most of the black and Puerto Rican characters portrayed in the film were pimps or drug addicts or worse. The committee demanded changes to the script, they threatened to sue, and they organized public demonstrations against the filmmakers.
Some of the protesters did go a little too far, and yes, there were security concerns on their part.
It got tense.
Christopher Novak was the film's art director.
They started demonstrating and wanting to obstruct shooting. So we had to have security on, and the police presence made it even more difficult. So it was a very tense situation.
Novak says the producers would deliberately try to keep the shooting location secret in order to avoid clashes with demonstrators and other angry residents.
We had a couple of incidents where people got on the rooftops and threw things down at the crew, like toilets. Shattering porcelain from six or seven stories is a pretty exciting event.
The same thing actually happens in the movie when rioters throw a toilet off the roof at the cops. The film's producer, Gil Champion, remembers things differently. He says reports of the protesters disrupting the shoot were exaggerated.
We did change a couple of locations, which we felt wouldn't be the best place to shoot at. But all in all, despite what might have come out in the press, we shot the movie on schedule, on time, made a lot of friends.
Champion says relations with the local residents were basically good, and he rejects the charge that the filmmakers were there to exploit the neighborhood.
We were exposing something that the world hadn't seen, that there was areas like this within our country, and that hopefully there was a chance for people to earn a better life somehow.
Champion says the production also spent a lot of money in the South Bronx and hired neighborhood residents to work as extras. But art director Christopher Novak says there weren't enough jobs available to satisfy the locals.
A movie crew, even though there's a lot of people on it, everybody has a very skilled position in it. And it's also all unionized, and so that was a difficult situation. So we couldn't really offer them jobs.
In interviews at the time, Paul Newman did seem troubled by the charges of racism leveled at the film, but he insisted the script was just as tough on the cops as it was on the pimps and drug dealers. The filmmakers deny that they changed the script to suit the protesters, though Harrison Barrero thinks otherwise.
You still have the blacks and Latinos or Puerto Ricans being prostitutes, dope peddlers, I mean the bad guys. But we saw in the film there was some conveyance of that there were white officers who were really bad also.
The protesters and other activists tried to organize a boycott of Fort Apache when it opened in 1981, but the movie was a box office success despite, or maybe in part because, of their efforts. The protesters did get one thing they wanted. At the beginning of the film, a written disclaimer flashes on the screen acknowledging that the film doesn't deal with law-abiding members of the community or, quote, the individuals and groups who are struggling to turn the Bronx around.
We're right in front of the infamous 41st Precinct of the New York City Police Department.
I met Harrison Barrero outside Fort Apache. In the 1990s, this stone bunker of a building was converted into office space for police detectives. Even Barrero had trouble recognizing it.
I mean, this is a beautiful building. It could be any government building. But it used to be an intimidating place with police officers hanging out and looking out like if somehow they were going to be assaulted. It looked like a fortress.
Today, the vacant lots around Fort Apache are filled in with new apartment buildings and single-family homes. It's a diverse working-class neighborhood. If you're looking for the burned-out shell the South Bronx used to be, you'll have to rent the movie because you won't find it here. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Just as celebrities and activists are supplanting news anchors, so-called real people are taking over for actors. Reality shows that dive into American subcultures are all over cable TV, from MTV's Jersey Shore to The Real Housewives of Atlanta on Bravo. The latest entry in this category is on Lifetime. It's called Russian Dolls, and it's focused on a neighborhood in Brooklyn, New York.
Brighton Beach is the immigrant experience.
It's like another planet. It's 1 square mile of Brooklyn jam-packed with crazy Russians.
Jesse Baker went to Brighton Beach for a little reality check.
Russian Dolls is crammed full of short skirts, short fuses, plastic surgery, and gaudy jewelry.
How many carats in this?
11 carats of diamonds, and it's 28,000.
Gorgeous. Big and blingy, and definitely Russian style.
The Russian culture you see on Russian Dolls is that the women of Brighton Beach hang out in bathhouses all day, drink vodka in Russian clubs all night, and their favorite pastime? Talking behind each other's backs.
Gossip travels in Brighton Beach faster than the speed of sound.
How do they do it?
I don't know.
Do we get those little cups with the string?
Drama, drama.
Gossip, gossip. That's how every single Russian girl is.
American popular culture likes to equate Russians with vodka and bears and those furry hats, but we show something a little bit deeper.
Something deeper is what Alina Miller, co-creator and co-executive producer of Russian Dolls, is looking for. Alina immigrated from Russia as a child and grew up in Chicago. She says the idea behind the show came from a desire to showcase a family on TV that looked like and sounded just like her own.
The next stop is Brighton Beach.
Brighton Beach is largely a working-class community, nestled under a subway trestle, the final resting place of the B train in Brooklyn. It became a stronghold of Jewish immigrants starting in the 1930s and 40s, and it's now often referred to as Little Odessa, because of the heavy concentration of immigrants who fled the former Soviet Union to rebuild their lives. Sergei Arinkin just moved to the U.S. from Kazakhstan and says he sees little resemblance on the show to the community he now calls home.
They took riot girls and scandal girls who can make a show.
Letters of criticism from Russian-speaking residents have complained about everything from the title of the show to the women in it. Local politicians and residents drafted a letter of protest to Lifetime before the show even premiered, asking the network to stop making ethnic cartoons out of their culture. Slate Magazine television critic Troy Patterson understands what the backlash is all about.
I take away that they're a bunch of borscht-eating gold diggers.
It's not about being flashy. We worked very hard for our success. It's about showing it more. It's how it is on Brighton Beach.
Russian Dolls, though, is not the first to paint a not-so-nice picture of Brighton Beach. Its rep on scripted shows is that it's a haven for the Russian mafia. Take CBS's Blue Bloods, for example.
Reagan. Brighton Beach. You kidding me? Grushenko, the mob boss? His son?
A Brighton Beach run by drug lords is the setting for the film We Own the Night.
I'm going to be heading up this new narcotics team starting this week. Russian unit out of PSA 1 in Brighton.
Yelena Menken is the director of the Business Improvement District in Brighton Beach and says these television shows are just peddling a product the world seems to want to buy.
We do not have museums and landmarks, but our culture, which is not talking about brand names and size of diamond. We are a nation of Tchaikovsky and Pushkin and Lermontov. That's what I would say.
Producer Alina Miller notes she is putting together a reality TV show here.
I know that people want us to show the librarians and the nurses and the computer programmers. I've read all of those comments, but that's not necessarily what is interesting to people.
Miller says the women of Russian Dolls are strong-willed and smart. And it seems they all share a distinctive quality. They're willing to talk behind the backs of their girlfriends, dump their boyfriends, and cry on cue in front of the camera. For NPR News, I'm Jessie Baker.
We've been through a summer of movie sequels. Now comes a fall of movie remakes, including Straw Dogs, The Three Musketeers, and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Our critic Bob Mondello was intrigued enough by this week's remake of a British gangster film called Brighton Rock that he decided to look at the old and the new side by side.
The 1947 Brighton Rock was black and white, based on a novel by Graham Greene about a character named Pinky Brown. Plenty colorful, in other words, a story set in a British resort town just before World War II.
More than ever,
playing Pinky, a violent, creepy 17-year-old gangster, was a baby-faced Richard Attenborough, the same guy who would later direct Gandhi and Cry Freedom, but who here was playing a real psychopath, chatting with his gangster buddies as he absentmindedly yanked out a doll's hair, strand by strand.
Now he can die.
Pinky's killed someone and will spend most of the film trying to cover his tracks. When he learns a pretty waitress named Rose could incriminate him, he sweet-talks her.
I like a girl who's friendly. You're sensitive like me. What's your name?
Rose.
You and me ought to get acquainted. You got a boy?
Not yet, I haven't.
So that she can't be forced to testify against him, Pinky will marry Rose, though sex repulses him, as does she, really. But with a woman's options being limited in the years before World War II, audiences knew she'd go along. The story turns darker and gets all tied up with sin and redemption as it progresses. Being Graham Greene characters, both Pinky and Rose are obsessed with Catholicism.
This won't be a real marriage. Not like when the priest says it.
At 92 minutes, the first Brighton Rock is snappy, well-acted, unnerving, pretty much a model gangster flick. So even all these years later, you need a reason to remake it. Director Rowan Jaffe's found several. He shot in color, not black and white, updated the story a few decades to the swinging 60s, and got Helen Mirren and John Hurt to take supporting roles.
I came as soon as I could, either.
I thought I'd live in fear of anything, except the atom bomb, of course. Certainly not a bunch of kids. One kid.
Brighton Pier doesn't look all that different, though it's actually Eastbourne Pier this time, but the people sure do. The town is overrun by rioting teenage mods and rockers.
Leave it to me, Pinky.
Yeah, I run it.
It's an era of social and sexual upheaval, providing new reasons for Pinky to feel insecure, and giving Rose more options. She could learn a trade, make her own way, not rely on Pinky, which makes her going along with him problematic. The film tries to solve that by playing her with more determination, more spunk. At one point, Pinky, played by Sam Riley, drags her furiously to the edge of a cliff, trying to frighten her.
Scared.
But she holds his gaze and melts him with her trust.
Not when I'm with you.
There's a lot of fancy filmmaking this time around, substituting for fancy writing the last time. Where the first film had a lawyer spouting Shakespeare, this one mostly has visual panache, crosses and crucifixes rather than dialogue about religion. You can't accuse the new film of being untrue to the original book. It actually reinstates the novel's climax, which Graham Greene had altered in his own screenplay, probably because it would have been tough to film back then. But what audiences will remember from both pictures isn't that scene, but the one that follows, an ending that Greene invented for the first movie to end it on an eerie note. It wouldn't be fair to reveal it, but if you're new to the story or have only read the novel, it'll likely strike you as it struck movie audiences then, as cruel and kind all at once, a persuasive illustration of what a character in the novel calls the appalling strangeness of the mercy of God. I'm Bob Mondello.
Now, time for music.
Keep on taking your medication. Light that temper behind those pills. Your brain is flying. I'll see you leave crying. Just remember, it's bad to kill. I go with a psycho.
The song you're hearing is called Psycho, and it's from Irish singer Imelda May's new album, Mayhem. She discovered rock and roll and blues as a kid. Buddy Holly was her idol. So was Billie Holiday. Over the years, she's honed a trademark rockabilly sound. That's right, she's an Irish rockabilly singer. Imelda May joins me now from London, where she is currently on tour. Imelda, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you're on tour right now, but you began touring when you were just 16. What was that like?
Yeah. I don't know if it was touring because it wasn't that far away from home. I would have loved to go on tour, but I began singing in the basement of a pub called Brussels in Dublin. And it was all blues, rockabilly, country, all roots music and some traditional Irish. And that was it. I was smitten.
Were you even old enough to be in that club?
No, absolutely not. They used to sneak me in. But my parents were okay with it because they knew I was crazy about the music. I loved it. Actually, one night that I was there, Ronnie Wood came in and jumped up and played guitar and I got to sing.
Ronnie Wood, that's the Rolling Stones guitarist.
Yeah, and I got to meet him again recently.
Did you tell him?
I said, we met before, and he said, no way. So I was telling him and he remembered.
He remembered.
Yeah, I swore there was no way he could. And then he described the night in the club and he said it was weird, a little kid singing the blues in this little basement in Dublin.
He got me with the hook, those big bass notes, thunder in my chest, stuck in my throat, pulling me down, like a rumble in the ground, crawls up from the depths, with a deep down sound. Johnny got a boom boom,
Johnny got a band.
Your music, which is a mix of rockabilly and blues, is not what you hear on mainstream, you know, music radio right now. Has it been hard to get a label to get behind you?
Initially, yes. I talked to some record companies. They didn't understand it. They said I need to choose one music or another. And actually, I was told by a few people, cut the rockabilly bit out and you'll do fine. So I decided to hell with them anyway. And I'm going to make my album anyway. And I made the album. And then I was on a TV show called Later with Jules Holland. So then my manager got a call from Universal Records and they said what we didn't get about Imelda May last month or whatever we get now, can we speak? And I said, absolutely.
Not all of your music is rockabilly, and one of those songs is Kentish Town Walt, which is a little bit different than some of the other tracks on your new album, Mayhem. Let's listen to it now.
Do you remember we traipsed around from pub to pound shop through Kentish Town? Only a five or two were named. The drunk on the doorstep had more to our shame. Living over the offie had its trials.
This is one of my favorite songs on your album. What is this about?
This is just about my life, me and my husband's life in particular. We were madly in love, still are, thank God. And we did have really tough times. The gigs were few and, you know, trying to get work, but we made the most of what we had and we stuck together. And, you know, my mother taught me well, and I could make a good stew on a fiver that can last 3 days if you keep adding to the pot, you know.
He plays guitar in your band.
He plays guitar. His name is Daryl Hyam, but I was concerned that we were married. Touch wood, it's all been great, and it's brilliant to see the world together, and it's wonderful.
But you're the one for all my life, my true love I have found. Yeah, you, my love, I found.
You're featured on a new tribute album for Buddy Holly that's coming out next month. And you sing his song, I'm Looking for Someone to Love. Let's listen to some of that. Is one of your heroes. What was it like singing on a tribute album for him?
Oh, it was absolutely wonderful, wonderful. I was very, very happy to do it. You know, I'm a fan of Buddy Holly's music. I think music has to be purely from your heart. You have to be able to put your heart and soul into it. And Buddy Holly was one of those people, and he was an inventor of music. He was a pioneer of this type of music, and also a lot of people don't give him enough credit for it. He was a terrific producer. So to be asked to be on such a CD, I did try and get True Love Ways, but that was already taken. I think it's one of the most beautiful love songs ever written. And also I did a recording of Ollie V just for the hell of it. We were having such a great time in there, we just kind of kept recording.
That's Irish singer Imelda May. Her new album, Mayhem, is out now. Imelda May, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're not here, but baby, I don't care, because I'm looking for someone.
Our program is directed today by Petra Mayer and produced by Phil Harrell, with Kenya Young, Brent Bachman, Lily Percy, Lauren Silverman, Megan Kane, and Connor Donovan. The technical director is Melissa Marquis, assisted by Michael Cullen and Renee Pringle. Melissa Goh is the weekend web producer. Our reference librarian is Key Molesky. Rick Holter is our senior editor. And special thanks to Russell Lewis, Uri Berliner, Andrea De Leon, and all the people involved in our coverage of Hurricane Irene this weekend.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Our producer is Mike Katziff. Culturetopia is executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.